From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Leonardo DiCaprio's played more downward spiral real-life figures than anybody I can think of, from Frank in Catch Me If You Can to Jim Carroll in The Basketball Diaries to Howard Hughes in The Aviator in his newest film. He is Jordan Belfort in The Wolf of Wall Street. Leo, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to do the show.
What attracts you to these guys? So, I mean, I think about these. So many of the real-life figures you play, though, have been even Rambeau in Total Eclipse. There are all these guys who are on this path. They kind of can't stop.
You know, I think that we're all beholden to a certain time period in our life where we're incredibly affected by art. And I think, you know, when I was 15 years old and I got the opportunity to do This Boy's Life with De Niro, I kind of needed to catch up on all of cinema's history. You know, and I'd done traditionally television to that point, and so my father was very intricate in introducing me to specific films, and of course I became fascinated by, you know, the 70s era, the director's era of making movies, and certainly Scorsese's early work with Taxi Driver, East of Eden was another very influential film. Those were the things that moved me at a very young age. I had a profound reaction to them, and since then it once you catch that bug, it's this addiction of trying to emulate something that good in your lifetime. And I don't think that's ever something that's quenched as an artist. You always compare to the gods before you and you say, well, it's never that good. I can never be that good. So it keeps driving you forward. And I've never, I don't think as an actor, really questioned why I want to play a role. I read a script and I sit with it. And if it still speaks to me, you know, weeks or months afterwards, I know it's something that I have to do, even if it's running on a similar theme, or if it's, you know, in some ways a repetition of something I've done before, that means there's something still left to be explored. So I've traditionally done a lot of those types of characters because those characters moved me as a young man, and they provoked an emotion in me, you know.
Those movies you're talking about, you know, the early Scorsese stuff or East of Eden, are all these figures who we know are doomed basically when we meet them, even if we know nothing about the movies. And there's something about that inexorable attraction to self-destruction in some ways that motivates you, isn't there?
I think so. I mean, I've certainly, with these last three films that I've done, I've been talking about it a lot, but there's been a fascination with financial corruption and greed and in America, and the corruption of that American dream, you know. In a lot of ways, it's been about, you know, the recreation of oneself to achieve this idealistic image of what a great American must be. I mean, that's prevalent in Gatsby as well, so much of that. I mean,
but there's an innocence in Gatsby, though. I mean, because he's really trying to make himself into something pure.
Yes.
He's trying to leave his background.
I mean, his
behind.
Motivation is completely different than Jordan Belfort's, and that's quite clear.
That's one way to put it,
The way we start this movie off, and you know, right off the bat, we dish out to the audience exactly what they're going to see for the next 3 hours, and that is a guy that is incredibly narcissistic, giving into every possible indulgence he can with complete disregard for anyone except himself. Whereas Gatsby, you know, the purity of that character is, yes, he went into the underworld to create his fortune, but it was for the love of a woman, you know.
And but also, there's the difference seems to be is that Gatsby wants to be an adult, and Jordan is basically infantile. You
yes.
know, he wants to remain a teenager forever,
yeah.
doesn't he?
Well, in a lot of ways, there were, you know, two sides of the same coin, you know, both these characters. Gatsby is almost, to me, it's the greatest pretender of all. I mean, the more I read that book, the more I just became incredibly fascinated with the idea of this young man that wanted to be a Rockefeller, wanted to be a great American. He wanted to be the new aristocracy of Long Island, so to speak. And you know, he created himself in the underworld, and it's such an existential book. And it just, the more you read that novel, the more powerful meaning it has. This film, on the other hand, we knew we weren't taking on sacred American literature. You know, we knew we were trying to do a reflection of something that's in the very fabric of our culture right now. And that's what is so kind of polarizing about this film and why it's getting such a strong reaction and, you know, why some people, I think, are missing the point of what this movie's ultimately about. But it's fascinating to me nonetheless because I think that's the era that we're living in. I think that no matter what we say, that's the era that we're living in. For whatever reason, through the evolution of man, we have not been able to conquer that one incessant need to accumulate as much as we possibly can.
It's occurred to me that some of the guys you played, maybe until even Jordan, are guys who always want to seem older than they are. Mm. I mean, they're all guys who want to, like, even, I was really struck by watching Basketball Diaries again, how he really wants to be taken as a man, Jim Carroll. Mm-hmm. It's more important to him than anything mm-hmm. that he looked upon as a man, as an adult. You can say the same thing about Calvin. You can say the same thing about Romeo. There's some of these guys you played who want to be thought of as grown men.
Absolutely.
And that's a fascinating thing to have play through your career.
Especially somebody who I think is like me, who's grown up in this industry in front of everybody. You know, I did an interview before this and people were like, what did your parents think about Wolf of Wall Street? Did they? I wanted to say, look, I'm 40 years old. At this point, I've been doing this for 25 years. Who cares what my parents think about it? Look, I'm doing something for a specific reason. But yes, I've been sort of, you know, I've been doing this for such a long period of time that I think that not only the themes of the films that I choose, I think people connect me with them in a lot of ways. And that is absolutely the truth. I mean, I'm fascinated with the subject matter. I don't know if I'm going to do any more movies about it, but the idea of where I came from in Los Angeles, seeing how the other half lived, seeing how, you know, people in this industry got to do this professionally for a living. You know, I keep saying this, but I was like Nick Carraway. I was within and without. I lived within the vortex of Hollywood, but I wasn't a part of it, you know. I had to sort of fight and hustle my way to become that and prove myself as a man in the process. And it's been a bizarre journey, but it's definitely had a reflection on the type of movies that I've chosen as well, I think.
I feel like that too, because also there's a kind of innocence in some of these things that you've done with these guys trying to prove themselves as adults. And in the case of Wolf of Wall Street, there's kind of a built-in cynicism to this, where this guy sort of basically sees the system as a way to be played.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which feels like, to me, the break between these things. You know, there's a line between Gatsby and Jordan. It's that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, you in this in these financial institutions and the world that we've seen since 2008 is these loopholes, and it's almost like a breeding ground for bacteria. You attract a certain type of person that's going to find loopholes within the system to take advantage of others.
Breeding ground for bacteria.
But it's truth. It's the truth. Jordan to me is not that. He's not. Look, he wrote this book as a cautionary tale. People have had some.
Yeah, because in reading the book, there's almost like in each chapter, and then that moment where he like walks into basically the boiler room, it's almost like a cartoon, like bulb goes off over mm-hmm. his head, and there's a bit of a smile in the book. I mean, it's.
No, absolutely. We wanted to reflect the absolute sheer utter enjoyment of how great of a time these people were having, screwing people over and living the life of, you know, Roman emperors. That's the movie we wanted to make. We didn't want to make a traditional sort of film that had a didactic approach to how people should feel about.
But you've never done that kind of film anyway. I mean, what's
well, this one in particular, I think, was very bold in that regard. Right off the bat, he explains what his attitude is. You know, there's no discovery process. It's like, look, this is the movie you're going to see. This is the man I am, and this is my attitude about the world that I live in. So you're going to sit here for the next 3 hours and deal with it, and that's important to me because, you know, what Marty said to me, and he's done many films like this that I think are polarizing, that take chances from Mean Streets to Last Temptation of Christ.
But there's a sense of Catholic, those films you named, Last Temptation of Christ, Mean Streets, there's a sense, a pervading sense of Catholic guilt. These guys are tortured. Even Henry Hill, to some extent, feels like he's waiting for the left hand of God to come down and crush him. Mm-hmm. In this movie, he's above the law. This is the first Scorsese movie I can think of where there's been the kind of pure pleasure, almost like something like Kiss of Death, mm-hmm. where the guy really enjoys his life of criminality and doesn't fear any kind of repercussion.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a hard line to walk the entire filmmaking process. There were so many moments in this film where, I think we could have taken a more traditional approach. And, you know, it's certainly towards the end when the film gets very, very dark with my wife and the use of drugs, we kept saying, look, if we don't portray this man's attitude during this time period, and I do want to preface this by saying that, you know, he's a very different person now, but for where he was during this time period, this is who he is. Let's be authentic about that. Let's not try to apologize for that, and let's not try to create him into something that he wasn't. You know, I think that he was riddled with guilt, certainly afterwards and probably during that time period, but for that brief fleeting moment, he felt like a god. He felt like a cult leader, that he was, you know, that he was above the law.
Well, yeah, that's for me also, this is the difference between this and so many other films, so many other Scorsese films, the ones you've been mentioning here, is that sense of looking for grace. I mean, these guys want to be redeemed in some way or another. And for Jordan, the redemption is the pursuit of immediate pleasure. I mean, mm-hmm. That's what redemption is to him, getting everything he wants the moment he wants it. And I just wonder if you talked with Marty about that this felt like such a break from these tortured protagonists that he had before. I mean, Jordan's tortured by everybody else, but he himself is not tortured.
No. To us, it was capturing something that is in the very fabric of our culture. What we're ultimately trying to portray is something that is rampant out there in the world we live in. But as filmmakers, what we wanted to explore was what's so enticing and fun about it. What's so interesting? What makes somebody not look at the wake of their destruction? And taking a non-traditional approach to that was what was interesting for us to do on this large of a scale of a film, because you don't see films like this. I mean, I keep referencing Caligula over and over again, but that's the closest thing I can reference when I'm talking about this movie, because, you know, they gave into every hedonistic indulgence.
Have you seen Caligula?
Yeah, I have.
It's truly an awful movie.
I know, but but it's that attitude.
When you say that, people are going, wait, Caligula, what are you doing? But there's even in Caligula, there's a kind of sense of fear. I mean, you know, he's created this. This will be the first time in history I've ever had to go into some depth about Caligula. So let me thank you for that in advance. But everybody around him, there's this sense of fear that if you don't go along, that you will be punished.
Yes.
But Jordan sees himself as a superhero. When he gives that speech and he talks himself out of quitting,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that to me is the moment in the film that really sort of encapsulates what he is, because it's both...
Me too.
A hedonistic moment and a completely narcissistic moment.
Absolutely. And it wasn't really until I got up on that stage that I realized what he must have felt like. Because I'd been thinking about those speeches for probably 6 or 7 years. I mean, that was part of the reason why I wanted to do this movie. I mean, there were some of the most... Terry Winter wrote some of these incredible monologues.
You're talking about Terrence Winter, who wrote the screenplay.
Wrote the screenplay. Wrote these incredible monologues that were like these Braveheart war cries. They were like out of Gladiator or something like that, but they were completely twisted. They were to, you know, reinforce in those people that were listening to him to go out there and screw as many people over as possible and do what is right for you, and that the almighty dollar is king and that makes you a better person. And they were completely surreal and twisted. So I'd been thinking about how to do these for such a long period of time, but it wasn't really till I was on that stage that I kind of felt, you know, the bizarre world that Jordan was living in, where he was almost like a cult leader. And even though these extras were like cheering for me after everything that I said, and I knew it was, you know, because they had to do it, and we were there for 3 days doing these speeches, I felt like a rock star. I felt like somebody that was a huge, you know, influencer, and that energy of having these people follow me in this twisted way became the character ultimately. And that's when I felt closest to what he must have felt like during that time period than anything I did in the movie.
We have to take a break. I'll think more about Caligula and be back with Leonardo DiCaprio.
We can drop Caligula if you want.
No, I'm hooked. We'll take a break. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Welcome back. It's the Caligula Hour. I'm talking with Leonardo DiCaprio about his newest film, Wolf of Wall Street. It's The Treatment. But as you were talking about that speech, I guess what I thought about is, and this is a rarity for you too, this is the first time you played a guy who's not really a loner. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these guys you played and these movies you've done, these guys who are, it feels almost like temperamentally incapable of having people around them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if one of the things that attracted you to this is a guy who really wants to build a family around him, mm-hmm. who wants to feel like he's, again, that in some ways it goes back to this thing I've seen in your movies where these people want to be an adult.
Yeah.
And his exercise of adulthood is trying to take care of people.
Yeah. Well, I think you are right. I think in a lot of ways that's how he viewed it. I think he was creating, you know, his own family in a lot of ways. I mean, he didn't belong anywhere. That, you know, there's one scene in with the FBI agent that I have on the boat where he goes, well, you know, Jordan, a lot of these guys, you know, their fathers were like this before them, their grandfathers were like this, but you got this way all on your own. He's a self-created man in the context of what he thinks, you know, the hi-hat guys on Wall Street were supposed to be like. And so he created this completely fabricated world to have a sense of family, I think. You're absolutely right.
But he fits to that Scorsese thing. You think so many of these characters, I mean, King of Comedy or Taxi Driver or Mean Streets or even to some extent in Shutter Island, these guys who are kind of self-mythologizing. Mm-hmm. They kind of build these narratives around themselves. Mm-hmm. And it gives a reason to sort of eschew conventional three-act narrative and just mm-hmm. make these guys who are creating stories as they live their lives. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if that's something that ends up being maybe subliminal or conscious, I don't know, but that idea is
very conscious. I mean, really, I've done four films with Marty before this. You know, The Aviator having been one of the films that took 8 years to make that I pushed him to make, and I'm so proud that he ended up doing. But I think that with this film, it was inherently a New York story as well. It was kind of tailor-made for the types of films that Marty's done in the past. And by no means is it a trilogy to Goodfellas and Casino, but it's along the same vein. It's almost like, where would these guys' children have gone? They would have tried to, you know, put a white collar on and, you know.
It's almost the guys who have grown up seeing Casino want to live like that.
Exactly. And they're all influenced by that. I mean, there's tons of references to cinema and trying to emulate these guys within this movie, you know. But it was an interesting journey for me because, you know, I was very specific about Marty, with Marty from the onset of saying, look, these are some incredibly disreputable people. People are not going to like these guys at all. And we're going to portray them, you know, for what they were during this time period and not try to sugarcoat it. And he goes, look, I've done many films like this. You know, many films have gotten incredibly polarizing reactions when they first come out. I'm used to it. But he goes, there's an importance to making movies like this. And I'm not going to judge who these people are. And I think that's the difference in Marty's approach in making movies. He doesn't look at himself as better than them. You know, he doesn't try to, you know, ultimately take these guys down a notch. He wants to understand the very sort of darker side of human nature and why we're attracted to these things and show it in all its glory. And he says, as long as you don't try to, you know, try to give them some false sense of sympathy or empathy or tack on some crappy didactic reasoning for their actions, you are saying something about the culture and the world that we live in and therefore human nature. And that's why it's important to do stuff like this. And that resonated with me. And I think that's a pretty damn good theme for making movies in general. You know, it's a powerful one. And why his films, to me, as an audience member, have had longevity. You know, they're not a product specifically of their time. These films explore something about who we are, the darker nature of who we are, and they live on for decades. His films, I watch, when one of his films comes on, I can't turn it off, you know.
Which one resonates the most for you? Which one do you?
By far and away, I think Taxi Driver for me.
Which again is another self-mythologizing guy who's writing a diary, who's not a conventional hero, all these things we're talking about.
I'm completely obsessed by that movie. I mean, I just, to me, it is just about the greatest independent film anyone could ever make. It took incredible chances. It was about a specific time period in New York, a New York that I kind of remember, a very seedy New York, you know, pre-Giuliani, where was shady. Stuff that I remember still, you know, being 39 years old when I first went to New York. But the idea of a protagonist that betrays you, it was so powerful to me at 15 years old. I was just rocked. I identified with this guy's loneliness. I understood him.
You saw him when you were 15 for the first time?
Yeah, when he took her to the porno, when he took her to the,
Shepherd, to the porno theater. Because he doesn't understand.
I was sitting there, what's that, I don't know if the word is schadenfreude or whatever. No, that's a different word, but there's a German word that we don't have in English, and it's about feeling, you know, embarrassed for somebody else. And he did that in King of Comedy too, when Jerry Lewis takes her, he takes Jerry Lewis, his date to Jerry Lewis's house, and he's like, what are you doing here? I've never felt that in a movie before. And in Taxi Driver, the idea that this character that I was so close, I closely understood, betrayed me, and he's all of a sudden, you know, pulling a homemade, you know, execution device out of his arm to kill a senator, and he's shaved his head. You're like, who was I watching this whole time? To me, it's so incredibly powerful because it does what cinema can do unlike any other art form, and that is immerse you in somebody else's mindset as a voyeur, as an audience member, and be submerged in that reality so completely that the rest of the world washes away and you no longer have an identity. And that's what that film did to me.
Because I've often thought that the real definition of great acting is the actor who can pull you into whatever psychological state he's feeling at the moment, mm-hmm. no matter what you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is that. And your career has been this thing of doing that. And when you got started in the 90s, you basically made, throughout your career, have made movies that have flown in the face of what the conventional wisdom is of offering heroism, of sort of trying to pay things off. And as you're talking about Taxi Driver, there's an obvious sort of emulation of that, of finding these heroes who do betray the audience.
I think it's the unreliable protagonist. Look, you know, coming from the world of nothing, so to speak, and kind of hustling my way into becoming an actor, and then getting this, what you have to understand is, like, I came from the world of, you know, competing with every other young actor out there, and then boom, there's this one role that was, you know, the Maltese Falcon of roles to have for a teenager, and that was This Boy's Life, starring role with Robert De Niro. It's like, there was nothing bigger, and there was this huge sort of storm of competition to get this role, and I got it. And from that point on, I said, I have hit the lottery, and if I don't, I'm not going to go spend all my goddamn money out on a brand new Porsche and a beautiful house and be broke next week. I'm going to hold on to this and let this ride. And since then, it's been this attitude of, honestly, if I screw up this opportunity that I had when I was 15, I'm like doing a disservice to myself. I want to try to do something. I want to at least try to, you know, reach for, performances within myself, or at least attempt to, that hopefully are as good as the stuff that I saw when I was that age.
Because you're talking, I mean, and then thinking, you mentioned Issa Vieten, so many of these characters you played are these guys who are extraordinarily lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, what is that emulation of these guys we're talking about in these movies that you saw? You certainly say that about Travis Bickle or many of the protagonists. Even Rupert in King of Comedy is an extraordinarily lonely guy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that something that you feel you've been trying to find a way to play in so many of these movies?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, I talk about a lot about where I grew up and then the fact that I was accepted into this magnet program, this great school at UES, which was a magnet of UCLA, and it was kind of an experimentational elementary school. And I lived, you know, on the east side. I lived close to Silver Lake, and I was chosen, you know, as, you know, for a scholarship with three other kids, and I was one of them chosen, and I got to go see how the other half lived. So therefore, I got to see how Beverly Hills lived. Yet I went back home to the east side, and I didn't really have many friends or much of a community around me in my neighborhood. I was hanging out with those kids, but then I went back to the east side. You know what I mean? So much of that the identification of seeing those films, I identified with that loneliness, I think. That loneliness was something that I immediately gravitated towards when I watched those movies. It struck a huge chord in me.
What I really you're talking about this kind of sort of trio of the American dream rotting from the inside. Mm-hmm. And it really, if you're talking about that sort of invention of yourself as landed gentry and having servants, I mean, it really begins with Django Unchained.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to think that's a big part of the reason you want to do that movie, too, just to expose. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that, you know, in that movie, Sam Jackson's, I mean, I think that's the most original character that Quentin's ever written. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy who's really a villain
I agree.
And for that to not get the kind of notice it deserved, and also in performance terms as well, in the way you guys work together, and for Jordan Belfort to be looked at, people somehow thinking the movie is glamorizing or condoning, this must seem like some monumental weirdness, does it not?
It does. I mean, then you got to sit back and say, okay, we should never have done, you know, a film about Randolph Hearst and never have done Citizen Kane, and we should have not, I'm not comparing it to those movies at all, I'm just saying, what is our subject matter? Where do we draw the line? Should we just do films about heroes, and should we just do films about Gandhi? I mean, honestly, what is the big? To me, I mean, those are the most influential films that I've ever seen. Those films that explore the darker nature of who we are in a context that isn't judging them. It's exploring human nature. I mean, I've been talking so much about greed. My head is spinning for this film and trying to get people to understand that, yes, this is a cautionary tale, obviously, you know. And there's a great irony to the ending that, you know, most of these people in Wall Street have not suffered the way they should. You know, they didn't pay the price. And, of course, in America, we get to reinvent ourselves once again. And these guys have gotten bonuses through the wazoo, and they've destroyed and decimated our economy. I mean, this guy, like I keep saying, Jordan is different now. He's a different person, but he represented during that time something about the attitude of who these people are. But yeah, I mean, with Django Unchained, I mean, you know, what type of films do we want to make here? You know, if you're not going to do films that, I mean, Sam Jackson said the same thing that Marty said to me on this. You know, to understand, for me to play that character, a white slave owner that deals with human life as currency and is completely obsessed with power and incredibly racist and a product of that time period in his environment. He said the same thing to me that Marty said, you know, because these were two kind of risky films in a lot of ways. He said, "Look, you know, you can't sugarcoat this stuff. If you don't go the distance, you're doing a disservice. You're not telling the truth. And ultimately, you know, that's not only a disservice to the movie, but what we're trying to say here. You know, not that the film is trying to be, you know, expositional about any kind of a message, but if you're not honest about it and your portrayal, then you shouldn't even be doing the movie."
Well, that's a sobering note to end on, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this, Leo.
Thank you. Thank you. Great interview. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
My pleasure. My guest is Leonardo DiCaprio, whose new movie is not Caligula. It is The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by Martin Scorsese. Our recording engineer at the Four Seasons is Will Bentley. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm not Django. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.